how can we learn to speak the language of the earth and cultivate our intuitive intelligence? What lessons can we learn from non-human animals about living in greater harmony with nature?
How have we contributed to making planet Earth a more dangerous place? And how can we work to save it? This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
It's interesting, as I've gotten older, I've really started to reflect back on that early time growing up on a farm. And I'm fiercely, fiercely proud of where my roots are in Weldon, Saskatchewan. It's a town of 160 people there today, right? So we were just back in Saskatchewan here at the end of August. And just being in a spot where every day you have cattle to feed, you've got a grain crop you're trying to grow, right? Things are subject to weather. The sort of the ups and downs of farm life is so dependent on the 6 p.m. news and the weather forecast each night. At times stressful, but most times incredibly rewarding, right? There's nothing like sitting in a combine at harvest time with all the fruits of your labors coming in at the same time. It's a great experience.
It's such a privilege sort of swimming through these places, and I almost feel like I'm getting a secret peek into the body of the planet. That's a very precious and almost a sacred kind of collaboration where I get to experience this, I get to see this. But if I'm going to take these insanely challenging risks, then I need to make it worthwhile and share what I've seen so that other people have the benefit of understanding a better conception of our connected planet.
I was originally drawn to bees because they're social creatures. And as humans, I always wanted to know about ourselves and how we can be our healthiest selves and our healthiest society. Bees and wasps and all of these organisms have been around for so long. Bees especially have been around for 100 million years. I really wanted to continue my work in graduate school so that I could better understand how a beneficial organism like these pollinators and bees stay healthy and what lessons we as humans could learn from them. I knew the work that I was doing into bee health and how to save the bees and what lessons we can learn. I knew that was more important than ever.
We definitely know that all animals have language. They talk to each other, they understand each other, and they have interesting ways of communicating that only recently have we figured out, even in part. Rhinos use a breath language. Fish use luminescence. Squid can actually send different messages, one on one side of their body and one on the other side of their body, with color and light and patterns. So they can ward off an enemy on one side by looking very fierce, and on the other side, they can be greeting a friend. We do know cows have facial expressions that are so subtle you can't really notice them, and that cats and horses use their ears and their tails and their whiskers and so on. But animals communicate with sounds too. And we know that elephants rumble and they purr and they almost growl, but they do it subsonically under the ground. And you need instrumentation to capture that sound. Humans can't really get the nuance of it. And it's not just sound. It's that a mile away, another herd of elephants hears that. And they don't just think, oh, there's a herd over there making a noise. They know that that means there are people with guns threatening our children, or we have found water, come over here and enjoy it.
We had cattle, which is just a never-ending thing, right? Our vacations were tied around going to cattle shows, cattle sales, bull sales, cow sales, anything that revolved around the farm. And we had a ton of fun on our vacations and going to these events and seeing sites in those areas where we went to. But at the end of the day, your life revolves around the cattle on the farm. It revolves around the farm, right? There's no sort of, hey, we'll take 4 months off and not worry about it, right? Those cows have to be fed twice a day and looked after. So it's a lot of responsibility. It's a great way to get yourself ready for life as an adult, for sure.
Water insecurity and water scarcity is affecting all people in almost every part of the world at this point. By 2025, we expect 1.8 billion people to suffer from water scarcity, which means they have no access to clean, safe drinking water within a 30-minute walk of their home. And then two-thirds of the global population are experiencing water stress, which is to say that they can no longer predictably rely on that water source to either be available and or safe to consume. That is where we stand virtually today. You fast forward by 2050, and we expect that to be 6 billion people that have water scarcity. So the rate at which this problem is increasing is far greater than the current infrastructure that has supported water for humans. And that's where innovation and rapid deployment of technology at scale is really essential.
I think that we have sort of surpassed the luxury of being able to say, no, we can't re-engineer biology. It's adaptation, right? And it's either going to happen naturally or we're going to help it along. And when you think of the planet today, like the proliferation of invasive species that are outcompeting native species, like we are really intermingling the biology on this planet these days with the way we travel and move goods around. And so, yeah, I do think that engineering is going to be a part of the future and sustaining or maybe even reintroducing some recently extinct species, for instance. I don't know how far we'll go in terms of like the Jurassic Park thing, but those kinds of ethical decisions need to be made globally.
I'll say this for humans and our brains. I think that in terms of many kinds of things, we are the extreme animal. Technologically speaking, there's no comparison to what humans can do among all the animals that make some tools. But that's just a matter of degree, mostly, not really a matter of kind. It's a matter of degree. And I think the most crucial thing is that while we are such extraordinary tinkerers that we can keep doing trial and error and figure things out and creating unbelievable kinds of technologies, we are not very smart about what we do with those things or seeing them through to the implications of what happens when we do these things. It's almost like, as a species, we are just like chimpanzees with automatic weapons, or we're just teenagers who are constantly doing stupid and reckless things, but we never seem to collectively as a species really grow out of it. If we were as logical and as empirical as all the other animals and were capable of the technology we're capable of, we would not be creating planetary problems that we are not psychologically capable of solving. And that's what we are doing.
With coral reefs, it's just one animal, the coral, which is a foundation species. So you impact that and you impact so many other species. You go to a coral reef and it's just teeming with life. You know, everything from turtles to small fish to all the crabs and crustaceans, and it's all dependent on that coral. So once that dies, the whole system shifts to a sort of an algae-dominated environment, and it finds it very, very difficult to recover. So it's so important that we protect these foundation species. We forget how important coral reefs are. We think they're a great place to go for a snorkel while we're on a summer holiday, but we don't think of their value. This is one of the most valuable ecosystems on the planet. Something like 25% of all marine life live on coral reefs, and they provide the coastal barriers that protect our shorelines and sort of break up that wave energy. So there's all these benefits, and they are a great place for finding drugs for anything from pain relief to cancer medications. You know, there are so many different species with such strange behaviors and adaptations that we can learn so much from them.
We have to solve three problems. We have to create a low-waste society through incentives to change individual behavior from consumer to user, through loss and waste prevention, intelligent resource management. We also have to create a low-carbon society by preserving the water, electricity, CO2 emissions embodied in physical assets, or through innovation in green electricity and circular energy. And the third challenge, which is probably the biggest, we have to create a low anthropogenic mass society by preserving the existing stocks of infrastructure, buildings, equipment, vehicles, and objects. The only strategy I know that can fulfill these three challenges is a circular industrial economy. Now, the last point, the low anthropogenic mass society, is simply because some years ago, the rapidly growing anthropogenic mass has become bigger than the world biomass. That, of course, means we are destroying the biomass because we have a limited planet, and we are destroying biodiversity and replacing it with synthetic man-made materials and objects. And this, in the long term, means we are killing ourselves. So we have to stop producing anthropogenic mass, except in countries that don't have yet sufficient infrastructures for education, health, living, sufficient food to feed the population.
I think for me, a lot of people ask in my line of work as a climate scientist, how do you not just fall into a state of despair and really just see the really dark aspects of human behavior and our inability to correct our course and do the right thing? And the truth is that we all have to reconcile it in some way. And you can either be really consumed by those darker emotions and that feeling that people don't care and those sorts of ideas, or you can just try and see beauty where it is and connect with other people who are also doing their very best. So I think this kind of binary thinking of black and white, people are good or bad, isn't quite right. There's shades of grey, and sometimes people do the best that they can from day to day. But other times it's, I guess, a sense of being stubborn and believing that there is goodness out there. So I guess this was my way of processing a really large sort of planetary scale dilemma. How do you find meaning in a world that's changing so quickly? It's a big thing to think about.
I'm doing this new group called F-, which targets fossil fuel lobbyists and look at the extent to which they also represent people being harmed by the climate crisis. So in state capitals, there will usually be a group of, they're called the top dog lobbyists, like the leader of the pack. And these are the people you hire if you want to get access to legislative leadership. And they can have some clients doing wonderful work for conserving green space or local charities or youth programs, but they also represent fossil fuel companies who are really the architects of the climate crisis. And these are people like ExxonMobil and Coke companies and the American Petroleum Institute, who knew this would happen. They knew the climate crisis would happen, and they've been telling us that it won't, and they've been telling us not to believe our own eyes. And right now, in every state capital, they are doing everything they can to slow the transition from fossil fuels to renewables. Now, the reason it's so insidious that they're able to represent both fossil fuel companies and all of these other groups doing wonderful things, charities, ballet companies, religious institutions, schools. It's really insidious because if you were a lobbyist and your only client was an oil and gas company, you would have a hard time getting a meeting with some legislators. You would be seen as a villain, as someone complicit in the crisis. But if you also represent a local school, a local charity, an environmental group, suddenly it's a different conversation. And you are potentially a hero in the eyes of this legislator. You're someone representing the people of their district. You're bringing them hope and help and opportunity. And this is why it's so hard to raise awareness about the climate crisis. There is every temptation to take a break from all the bad news and the worry and just try to focus on the good news.
Don't sit comfortably on values that we consider are taken for granted. Go out and speak out for them and nurture them actively. Nurture the values of peace, of the values of democracy, of mutual understanding, of tolerance, of sustainability. Speak out. You have means that even my generation did not have. The social media, it's incredible how it can be mobilized so easily. So make the best of the means that you have at your reach to speak out, to engage, to discuss, to debate.
Balancing, I mean, for people who really care about these kinds of things, it can be really tough. I sometimes think of a quote by E.B. White where he says he wakes up in the morning, is torn by the urges to save and to savor the world. In other words, to be involved in solving the problems and yet not forget the tremendous beauty of being alive in this miraculous world.
We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. The interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan, and the associate interviews producer on this episode was Jamie Lammers. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions or our podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thank you for listening.